icy cold, juicy, and super sweet. Watermelon and muskmelon give us some of the best tastes of summer, and both grow well in home gardens. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. There are many kinds of muskmelons and watermelons for a home gardener to choose from. I'll talk about different varieties and best practices for growing melons with ISU Extension horticulturists Linda Knave and Richard Giron. Linda and Richard will also answer your questions about the plants and trees in your life. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and watermelon, muskmelon, those are some of the great flavors of summer. This hour, we're going to talk about best practices for growing melons in Iowa. And with me, Linda Knave, Iowa State University Extension Specialist in Value-Added Agriculture. Hello, Linda.
Hi. How are you, Charity?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today. And let's talk a little bit about melons. I mean, this is the time of year where we're starting to see them ready to harvest, right?
Yeah, they're coming on the local market about now. Some of the early producers, the early ones will be coming on, and then we'll have them through September. It's a wonderful time of year because the local melons, you just can't beat them, particularly the muskmelons.
And there are so many different kinds of melons. I was just doing a Google search, and there were, you know, dozens of different
varieties.
You know. Do they all grow well in Iowa?
A lot of them can be grown here, but they don't. Home gardeners can grow some of the novelty ones, but the market gardeners grow probably five or fewer different varieties. For example, we have different types of watermelon. We have the seedless watermelon, we have the seeded watermelon, we have the heirloom watermelon, we have the red-fleshed, we have a yellow-fleshed. So there we have lots of different kinds of watermelon. And then we have muskmelon or cantaloupe. We can talk about that too. And then we have some types of muskmelon like Crenshaws, honeydews, and these things. We do grow those. We do see those. But then there are things like the bitter melons, Santa Claus melons, and some of those that aren't real. You see them once in a while at the grocery store, but not real often. We could probably grow those here, but they're not. And then there's some of the winter darker other melons. But most of the ones that we see here are the honeydews, the muskmelons, and the different types of watermelon. And there are different types of muskmelons now, too. There are some that are deep orange flesh, like our traditional kinds, and some that have a salmon, kind of a yellow salmon, a beautiful color, citrusy grapefruit color. And they have a good flavor, too. So within the melons, there's a lot of different varieties. But types, we don't grow all that many types.
What are conditions that favor melons? What makes it a good melon season?
A good melon season is a hot season, like we've had. A lot of our watermelons like it lows in the 70s. They like highs in the upper 80s to 90. They grow like crazy. For example, a muskmelon, when you think about a muskmelon flower, it's about the size of, a little bigger than a marble. A grape tomato is what it starts, the fruit flower starts like. Then in 35 to 45 days, we have that 5-pound muskmelon. Watermelons, it takes maybe 55 days, 40 to 55 days, that we go from that size, grape tomato size, all the way up to a 20-pound melon in that many days. So you could almost see them grow. And this year was one of those years. It's amazing.
How about moisture? How does that affect them?
Moisture affects them. They need water because watermelons and melons are just almost 90-some percent water. So they need it during the growing season to produce not a nice foliage, because the foliage then feeds the fruit. But as you get closer to ripening, it's a good idea to taper off on the water, because you want the sugars to be more concentrated.
Right. So if there's too much water, it can kind of dilute the flavor?
Exactly. That's what happens.
Does it ever have a problem with swelling and cracking?
Absolutely. So right now, I think some of us Central Iowa watermelon producers are looking at our melon saying, we better get them out of the field, go in the mud and get them out, because after this 3 inches of rain and they're sitting there waiting to be harvested, they will absorb it, but they're at a full size and they're going to go, poof, crack. And that happens. And you can hear it in the field.
Oh, terrible sound.
Crack, yeah.
there go the profits for the season.
Or you pick this beautiful melon and it's really full of water and you set it in your trunk of your car or your van, or it goes crack as soon as you set it down. Don't even have to cut it open. That's a ripe melon.
Now, you mentioned muskmelon and cantaloupe earlier. What is the difference? Is there a difference?
Yes, I think there is. There is a difference, but I think if you go to research what the difference is, everybody has a different answer. It's kind of interesting. Now, a lot of the way we use that term cantaloupe or muskmelon is kind of like sweet potato and yam, that they're used, everybody calls it a sweet potato when it's really a yam. So theoretically, I think it is all cantaloupes are muskmelon, but all muskmelon aren't cantaloupes. So it's kind of odd. Now, if I were to give you a definition by my standards, a cantaloupe are often the ones you see in the grocery store off-season. They are more rounded than oblong. They're netted but not ribbed.
Okay.
And you can't, if you leave them in your car, it doesn't stink up your car. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
A muskmelon, how? And they're usually grown for shipping because they're firmer fleshed and they don't bounce around much. You know, when they're bounced around, they don't get mushy. Whereas a muskmelon, like the muscatine melons that we hear of, they are more of a muskmelon because they're more aromatic musk, you know, the flavor, the aroma, and they're softer fleshed, a little softer fleshed. And in my opinion, they're sweeter.
Yeah, they have a much more flavor, I think, just a stronger flavor.
But they've got a softer texture too. And it's that softer texture that's more conducive for the local market because you don't have to ship it very far. But it's not real good for a long-distance shipping. So that's why we see muskmelons coming on at farmers markets and roadside stands right now are the muskmelons that have the strong aroma, a little softer at the stem end when they're ripe. And they look salmony, peachy colored between the ribbing. Whereas the ones you buy at the grocery store may have been harvested a little earlier and they're not really colored up between the ribbing.
What makes Muscatine a place that melons grow so well?
That's a really good question. It's the soil conditions. It's a much sandier soil. They just grow crazy down there. And they started out, there's a pocket of growers down there that realized this is a good melon growing area. They irrigate, but they've got water availability, and it just grows really well there. And the temperatures and the climate's just perfect.
So, I mean, talking about sandy soil, if you try to grow muskmelons in your home garden, I mean, a lot of us don't really want sandy soil in our home garden.
No.
Does that mean we can't grow them as well?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. The heavier soils will hold more moisture. You won't need to irrigate and water as frequently. No, they grow pretty well on most soil types, but sandy soil is really good for them. They have a central sort of tap root, but not a real tap root, but it's more so than a lot of the fibrous rooted plants that go down deep and just get well rooted in. This year, we were talking the field station, Muscatine Island Field Station, our horticulture research farm down there, just got hailed on and had serious hail problems down there. So I was just wondering if others experienced hail down in that area, if it's going to affect our muscatine melon crop.
So we've had great weather for the most part for melons this summer, but an event like that can really...
Yes, cause a lot of problems.
Yeah, if you're growing melons in the Muscatine area, let us know how it's going. 866-780-9100 is the number to call, or you can email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Now, when melons get harvested, do they continue to ripen after you harvest them, or does that kind of stop the process?
It's kind of interesting with melons because they get sweeter because the foliage is producing photosynthates, which the sugars then move into the fruit. And with muskmelon, it's a situation where about 48 hours before they're really ripe is when most of those sugars move in. So if we harvest it 48 hours before it's really ready, most of the sugars aren't there. So the flavor isn't as good. They might color up, but it won't. But after it's been picked, nothing happens. The only thing that happens after it's been picked is the texture changes. It gets softer, but it will not get sweeter. So if you sit it on the kitchen counter, it's the last thing you want to do because it'll shrivel up fast. The best thing to do is put it in the refrigerator, but I suggest putting it in a large Ziploc plastic bag because You've had this happen as you open your refrigerator and the first thing that comes out is
Right.
that muskmelon aroma, which isn't that bad, but everything else starts to taste like muskmelon in your refrigerator
Right, and
too.
maybe for a while after you've had that muskmelon too.
Yeah.
And does I mean, obviously the plastic contains the odor, but also does it prevent desiccation? Do we have that problem in
Yes, we
self?
Do. We want to keep that melon humidity high.
Okay.
So by putting it in a Ziploc bag like that, or any kind of bag that holds in not only the aroma, but also that fragrance. And we don't want to put it in a location that has other fruits and vegetables that may be emitting ethylene. So it's just
Okay.
a good idea.
All right. And of course, it's not going to fit in the drawers that
No.
protect your fruits and vegetables from
That's
dehydration
a good point.
in the fridge.
Yeah.
Now, of course, when we buy watermelon, for example, at the store, most of the time these days you see seedless watermelon. And of course, we're growing watermelon from seed. Explain this for me, Linda.
It's an interesting science. It's been around longer than what you might think, because we haven't seen seedless watermelons on the market that terribly long. A seedless watermelon is typically more expensive. You've noticed that. And it's not just because somebody's gone and taken all the seeds out, but it's because of the process by which you get a seedless watermelon plant, both by the farmer's standpoint and the seed producer's standpoint. With that said, now let's say we're going to have a seedless watermelon plant. We're going to buy the seeds. The plants that those seeds came from were treated. They were treated with a product called colchicine. And what colchicine does is it changes the diploidy of that plant. So typical watermelons are diploid. They have two sets of chromosomes. Well, what this does is it turns it into a tetraploid. And so they get four sets of chromosomes. Kind of technical, isn't it?
Yeah.
But these plants then they do produce seed, but their seed has four sets of chromosomes. So they include with the package, or you have to buy additional. Now, home gardener packages, they usually provide it, but commercial size, they say, yeah, you buy a pollinator, because the pollinator will be diploid. Well, so, and you typically, if you have a very dark skinned or rinded seedless, you want to plant maybe a striped, so you know the difference when you harvest
it. Oh, sure,
it.
Yeah.
So your pollinator comes in, and then, so you plant a pollinator row, or a few plants of your seedless, a pollinator plant. So what comes out is, when they cross on that seedless plant, we get what's called a triploid plant. And a triploid is sterile.
Huh.
So those little white seeds in
there. So it's not a genetically modified crop. I mean, this is all in the process.
It's all in the process.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. And so you get, so the farmer in his field will have seedless watermelons, and then he'll have some seeded watermelons. Then there might be some that kind of have a few little black seeds, but not many. And those are usually the early ones.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. With me, Linda Nave, and it's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. We'll be answering your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call, or you can email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Linda Nave, Iowa State University Extension Value Added Agriculture Specialist. Also with us now, Richard Geron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. Welcome, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here. And of course, we are here to answer your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can also email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And before we entirely move away from melons, although of course you'll answer melon questions if people have them, I'm curious about the flavor of seedless watermelon, because, and maybe it's the difference between store-bought melon or melon that gets shipped, but I feel like the seedless melon that I buy at the store doesn't taste as good as seeded watermelon.
You know, I tend to agree, but I think that's a personal preference. Yeah, I think they're working on it. I think there's getting better flavored ones, but they're pretty. They're easy to cut.
Oh, yeah.
But
very convenient.
I tend to agree with you. I tend to like the flavor of the seeded ones better. And some of the fun seeded ones with the yellow flesh, the bright yellow flesh, are really good too. But they're odd to look at to eat for the first time, that this watermelon is pure, bright, brilliant lemon yellow.
But fun. Definitely a fun experience. Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite kind of either muskmelon or watermelon?
Which variety you mean?
Yeah.
Or, yeah, I do. I like Athena for a muskmelon. It's got the great flavor, great flesh. It grows to be a great size. Doesn't have a lot. It's a small cavity, which means that what you scoop out isn't so big, and what you have for flesh is good. Watermelon, you can't beat the Crimson Sweets types. That was, our Dr. Charles Hall bred that
Right,
one.
right.
It's been a popular one for years. But sangria, the oblong sangria, has an excellent flavor. And that grows anywhere between 12 and 20 pounds in
Wow.
size. So it's a big one.
Invite some people over.
Yes, for sure.
All right, let's get to the phones. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And Casey is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Casey.
Good morning. I have a question about my garden. The question is off and on through the years, my zucchini and yellow squash and pumpkins will just have a massive wilt and die. So I waited a year and I planted them this year, and the same thing is happening. How can I get that? I don't know what's going on. It's a
Well,
problem with cucurbits, I think.
it could be one of two things. It could be possibly the squash vine borer. Sometimes they'll basically chew into the stem near the ground and get inside and basically destroy much of the stem tissue, and the vine suddenly wilts and dies. So it could be the squash vine borer, or it could be some type of disease. The vine crops do have a number of wilt-type diseases that will cause very sudden wilting. So it could be either one of those two. If the plants are dead, I would pull the plant and I would take a knife and kind of slit the stem and look for that squash vine borer, which is kind of a white, pudgy, grub-like insect inside. And if you see that, then you know exactly what it is. If you don't see
Thank
that,
you.
then I would assume it's probably some type of wilt disease. And the best thing on that is to go ahead and rotate next year, destroy the dead vegetation this year, and look for an alternate site next year.
Understood. I also have a question about my blueberries. Why does a product called copperas help my blueberries more than any other iron or any other product? What is it with copperas that makes my blueberries thrive?
I'm not sure on that. They do require an acid soil, and the pH, for example, needs to be around 4.5 to 5.5. Our pH in Iowa typically is more like 6, 7, 7.5, and so we have to lower it. You can do that a couple of ways. One, you can use sulfur, but sulfur
Well,
is
I did that for y I did
right.
that for years with no luck. I mean, they just sat there. My blueberries are almost 12 years old, and I didn't even get a pint last year. So I started using a product called Copperas, and I actually harvested about 7 quarts this year.
Wow.
Well, I
So
don't
it's a
think
good
that's a
product.
pH
I don't know.
issue. I'm not sure, but going back to sulfur, sulfur does make the soil more acidic, but it's very slow acting. So if you apply it this year, it really doesn't have much effect on the pH until next year. So it is very slow acting.
Oh, Casey, thank you so much for your call. And a lot more people are growing
Right.
blueberries in Iowa these
Right.
days. Do you feel like they're growing better here now, or is this just kind of getting more popular?
I think we're getting smarter on how to grow them. The word's gotten out. You can grow them here. However, there are certain amendments you have to make to the soil and constantly amend it. And the pruning is a little bit different with blueberries and some of our other crops because they produce on third-year wood. So these kind of things, the more awareness we have about them, they can be grown here. And there are some varieties that are extremely hardy for our area. And
They have two basic requirements. It has to be an acid soil, has to be. It has to be a well-drained soil. If it's in a poorly drained wet soil, if we have a wet year, they'll get a root rot and they'll be gone. They'll die. So,
And you said the berries are produced on third year wood, so if you plant them, you're going to have to wait a few years before you actually get a crop, right?
yes.
But normally not 12, like Casey
No.
just waited. So I'm happy
No.
they finally have come through for
Yeah.
her. So no real explanation for that one.
And they have a nice fall foliage color. The foliage turns sort of a maroon red in the fall. So I think they have some landscape potential too.
4 to 6 foot type shrub, so not very big, but kind of a medium sized shrub.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Karen is on the line in Martell. Hi, Karen.
Yes. Hello. I have a tree question. We have a green ash that is probably 35 years old. And we, for whatever reason, this last couple years have noticed a lot more dropping of seed ball kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's around a patio, and it's just becoming such a messy tree. And we aren't sure if we just didn't notice it before or if there's something happening. Now, we obviously are aware of emerald ash borer. We have treated it with triage. It's a large tree.
Okay.
But I don't know why we're getting all of this debris falling
okay.
from it that we don't think we've had in the past.
This debris that's falling, does it kind of resemble small broccoli heads somewhat?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Uh-huh. Those are galls, and those are caused by a small little mite. And they attack the male flowers in the spring. The flowers are very small, inconspicuous, but they attack those flowers. And in response to that, the tissue grows abnormally. And so you get these galls. And initially they're green, a green in color. They resemble a small little head of broccoli. And then by typically fall, they turn brown. And they're kind of a dark brown. And they hang on the tree for quite some time. And then eventually they fall off. Well, those are male trees. And the nursery people, let's say 30, 40 years ago, decided to plant just male trees so they wouldn't produce the fruit. They didn't realize that this insect would cause these galls to form. And so we have all these male trees producing these galls. As far as the tree is concerned, it's perfectly healthy. But it is annoying if you have this tree above a patio or porch our driveway
right.
because of the dropping
right.
Of the galls. So, but the tree itself is fine.
Okay, well, that's good news. Is there anything that can be done
to prevent that?
To avoid those, yes.
Mm-hmm. The answer is no. Very short, no.
Okay.
It's just not practical, no.
All right, well, Karen, yeah, thank you so much for your
thank
call.
Thank you.
The number to call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Here's a question from Al in Ames. I'm planning to reseed my lawn next week. Do you recommend a 100% bluegrass or a mix?
If it's full sun, 100% bluegrass.
All right. And next week's a good time?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
This is the time we've been waiting for all summer whenever anybody asks about reseeding their lawn.
Mid-August to early September, right in the sweet spots.
Yeah.
All right.
The weather's going to be good, too.
Yes, should be.
All right, so do it.
Do it.
All right, this one's from Dave. I'll be cleaning out my chicken coop this fall after the end of the garden season. I use wood chips for bedding in the coop. Is it a good idea or a bad idea to put the chicken bedding with chicken droppings on the garden to compost for the winter? Thank you for your assistance.
Yes, they can do that, but don't put a lot on because chicken manure is what we define as hot. Even when it's blended with the chips. They might be concerned a little bit. If they work it in, it'll start to decompose. If it's fully decomposed by next spring, then chances are the nitrogen will be released. But be aware that there might be a little tie-up of the nitrogen, particularly with the wood chips. Now, the best time to apply that is, as he's doing, in the fall. And the reason I say this is for food safety. Incorporate it in, and then we want to say, for food safety reasons, we want 120 days before you would harvest anything from that field or that garden. And so in this case, we'll have that window pretty well covered.
And when you say hot, what does that mean?
That means it's high in nutrients and
so maybe
small amount
too
goes
high
a long
if
way.
You don't let it.
Right.
Okay.
Compost and
you
and
could
go
burn
out.
Your
so
plants.
Don't put too much on. A little goes a long way.
All right. The chickens don't seem to know that.
Mm-mm.
There's plenty to go around. All right. Here's a question from Earl. When can I cut my peonies down to near ground level, or can I cut them back that far?
Basically, you want to wait until late October, early November, because as long as that foliage is green, it's manufacturing food for the plant. And the more food they can store, the more flowers next spring. So wait until basically late October, early November.
All right. And I think Earl has a musical related question here. He says, also, what does the term deadhead refer to regarding plants? So it's not that you're a fan of the Grateful Dead.
No. When it refers to flowers, deadheading is removing the spent blooms. So you're removing the dead heads, so to speak, the dead flower heads.
Pretty literal.
It's very literal. So you'd go through and you'd deadhead. It's a different process of deadheading depending on what you're growing. For example, if you're growing marigolds or petunias, you'd just pick the dead spent blooms off. If you're deadheading roses, you would go back a little further down on the stem to the three leaflet leaf. But deadheading is simply taking that dead.
All right, and it's a good idea because then you're allowing the plant to put its energy into growth and
exactly. So and that looks a lot better.
All right, let's go back to the phones. 866-780-9100. Al is on the line in Fort Dodge. Hi, Al.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
Well, I have a question about trees. I removed an ash tree from my front lawn a couple of years ago, and I'm thinking of planting a Cleveland flowering plum. And I'm wondering how close to that site of the other tree can I plant this tree? And also, my space from sidewalk to the house is about 25 feet, and I'm wondering if that Cleveland pear would fit in that space well.
Yeah, Cleveland pear is an ornamental pear. It's very columnar. It may get to be 25, 30 feet tall, maybe 20 feet wide, so it should be fine. As far as planting it next to the tree, probably just a few feet away from the old stump should be fine.
All right, and conditions right now for planting a tree?
Would be fine for this fall, yeah.
But you have to make sure they're getting plenty of water if things dry up,
make sure that you
right?
water until the ground freezes in December.
All right, let's go next to Kenny on the line in Cedar Falls. Hi, Kenny. Hi, Kenny. Kenny, are you there? All right, we don't seem to have Kenny right now. You can join the conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And let's get back to some email questions. This one's from Fred. How do local growers determine when muskmelons are ripe? If the muskmelons are not going to be shipped, how do you decide when to pick?
That's a good question, and we didn't quite get to that in our earlier
right.
conversation. Muskmelons, it's a little easier than a watermelon to determine when it's ready. It sits in the field, it gets full size, and then it starts to change color between the netting. It'll change to sort of a salmon melon color, okay? That's one indicator. Another indicator is where that melon attaches to the stem, and if you take that, if you wait until it cracks off, it's a little bit further along. But we want it at what we call the full slip stage to get the maximum flavor. So if you give it a little tug, you pull the melon a little bit and hold the stem and tug it a little bit, and it forms this little crack and comes right off, slips off. That's the perfect stage. Now,
if you pull too hard and it's not perfect? Linda?
You can pull too hard and then you get a pigtail and then it's not ready. Then
right.
you better take it home anyway.
but I guess then you don't pick the ones that are next to
right.
it. Okay.
The color indicator is probably the best indicator. And sometimes even if you let it go to the point where it's a darker melon, salmon colored, it's a really ripe, so you better get it. But it doesn't mean it's overripe unless that's cracked, really cracked, and you start seeing picnic beetles at the side of the opening there. But overall, the longer you can leave it on, almost the better, till it slips right off, and then use it right away.
All right, what about melon thumping? This is a technique you see in a lot of grocery stores, people listening to the sound of the melon. What do you think?
I tell you, those people who can do that and pick a ripe one, God bless them, because I don't know how they do that. Because thumping, you can thump a green one and you can thump another one. And it's a variety thing, too. And it's like, how do you know? Maybe I'm tone deaf or something. I don't know. But thumping doesn't help. So with a watermelon, it's a little trickier. You wait till, again, they get full size. And the skin, the rind, will kind of turn a little duller than a non-ripe one. So that's, I guess, a judgmental call.
So if it's not as shiny
as
its neighbors.
And another indicator is before you roll it over, go back and find that little tendril. The little tendril is that curly Q that's the closest one to where the melon stem attaches to the main stem, there's this little tendril. And that should be totally browned off, okay? So that's another indicator. But the real key is you gently roll that melon over, and its belly, where it was touching the soil, should be kind of like a yellow butter color. And that's an indicator. If it's very light yellow, very creamy, it's not good. But it won't be the color of Richard's tablet here, but it'll be a butter yellow.
Okay.
And that's a really good indicator.
Now, with a lot of growers, I guess I've seen video of them just cutting a melon open in the field. And, you know, they know that they planted all of these at the same time. And if this one's ripe, the ones around it are probably ripe. That may not be as practical in the home garden. But is that, I mean, that'll tell you.
We call it a crapshoot, because if you have all those indicators and they all say, yes, pick it, you pick it, and the seeds are white, it's not ready. When they have black seeds inside, they're ready. It's ripe. But you have to cut it open in order to see black seeds. So that's a tricky thing.
All right. Sometimes you just have to pull the trigger. All right. We're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. With me, Linda Nave, Iowa State University Extension Value Added Agriculture Specialist, and Richard Duran, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. You can give us a call, 866-780-9100, or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. We are here to answer your questions about the plants in your life. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And with me today, Richard Duran, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist, and Linda Nave, Iowa State University Extension Value-Added Agriculture Specialist. And we've been talking a lot about melons this hour. And you wanted to add to we were talking about how to know when a melon's ripe. Mm-hmm. Also, you're supposed to read the package and then remember what's on the package.
Now,
how do you remember?
We write it down, but, you know.
What a good system.
Or save the seed package. But, you know, it gives you a good generalization as to when, if it says 85 days to harvest, you keep track of when you planted it. And then about 80, 85 days later, you can go look. And we find it's within about 5 days or so of being ripe. It's pretty close.
All right.
I mean,
so
especially
if you don't
melon,
trust any of the other systems,
right.
Just use the calendar. Write it on your Iowa State University Extension Horticulture calendar.
There you go. Planted my melons, yes. So that gives you a good time to look. So, because oftentimes you think, they should be ready. They've been sitting there. They're, you know, these watermelons are big. Well, it's only 75 days, not 85 days. And they're just sitting there getting all their sugars built up. They're not ready yet.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Bill is on the line. Hi, Bill.
Hi there. Thank you very much for taking my call. A call a little bit ago talked about a tree that a lady had that had a lot of dirty seeds and so forth falling from it. I've got a tree in my yard, and it's a huge tree, and I have no idea what sort of tree it is. And right now it's dropping perfectly round green balls. So I don't know that's mm-hmm. the shape that they are.
Size of a.
I'm just trying to figure out what sort of tree this is, and if it is an ash tree, you know, if I need to treat it, because it's a big tree, I wouldn't want to take it down if it didn't have to.
What is the size of those fruit? Are?
Well, they're not very big.
Okay, like a pea.
They're maybe smaller than a pea.
Okay, perfectly round.
Perfectly round.
Okay.
And a lot of them.
Okay. I'm thinking maybe a linden. They're a very common tree. They can be huge. Did you notice any fragrance around June? Because when they flower, the flowers are very fragrant, very sweet fragrance. Very noticeable.
Yeah, the tree does have a pleasant odor to it in the spring, but it's a dirty tree. I mean, it drops things
well
through the season.
Yeah, they do. They have a very unique flower structure and fruiting structure. They have these kind of surfboard-shaped structures. They're kind of a light green, and they fall to the ground. And then you have these fruit, perfectly round, kind of a medium green, about the size of a pea. Those are the fruit. So they can be a little messy, yes.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate taking my call.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your call, Bill. Let's do a few email questions here. This one's from Angela in Iowa City. I planted a new-to-me forsythia shrub on the west side of my home in Iowa City late this spring. The shrub is about 3 feet tall now and nicely green. Is there any benefit to wrapping it for the winter?
Shouldn't have to. It's perfectly hardy. Should be.
Mm-hmm. All right. Here's one from Mary. I have roses that grow very long, spindly branches that don't produce flowers. They get plenty of sun. What's the problem?
That may be a modern rose that maybe has died back to the graft union. They're grafted plants. And if that happens, then the rootstock, if it's still alive, will send up shoots. And that rootstock plant is very different. And typically it grows very, very rapidly. The leaves are a little bit different in appearance, and they typically never bloom. So if you have a plant that's doing that, I think you've lost the actual plant.
So. All right. Bummer.
Mm-hmm. Good comment.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Bob is on the line in Bettendorf. Hi, Bob.
Yeah, hi. There was a comment about blueberries in copperas. I think she called it copperas. Copperas is a byproduct when you're treating iron to make it stainless steel. It leaves iron sulfite. And I use it on red maples when they're chlorotic. What it is it turns the soil a little bit more acidic. It also gives some iron. Besides, works great on blueberries, too, as she said.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Could you spell that?
C-O-P-P-A-R-A-S, I believe.
Okay, so it's iron sulfate. So basically, as far as trying...
It's down at the hardware store, and... on a red maple, you apply it around the base, and you mix it sparingly into the soil and just kind of experimentally and see what happens.
Okay. So basically, as far as trying to acidify the soil, you can use just ordinary elemental sulfur. You can use copper sulfate, and you can also use ammonium sulfate. So you have options there. So that's
all right.
Good.
Yep. Bob, thanks a lot for the extra information there. Let's go next to Diane on the line in Rock Island. Hi, Diane. Hi, what's your question?
Call. I'm calling about daylilies. Once the blooms are done for the year, the greenery gets really shabby. Can you just cut it down? If you do, it starts to grow again, but I'm wondering if you're robbing the plant of next year's vitamins.
Yeah, if the foliage for the most part is still green, I would leave it. It may look a little shabby, but I would leave it. Now, if you have some dead growth, you can remove that. But again, the key point there is if it's still green, it's still manufacturing food, and it's storing that food down in the roots. And so next year, if you wait, you'll be rewarded with more flowers. So I would just leave it.
What happens when you cut it back, it forces it to use its reserves to produce new leaves so that it can sustain itself. But again, it's using its reserves that you want to bank on for next year. So don't cut them
all
the way
back. I wondered about that, and I have a friend who helps me, and she just doesn't like to see this half-dead leaf on the lilies and cuts it all back. So I thought, maybe not.
Now, daylilies are resilient, so no matter what you do to them, they basically come back. They may not just bloom very much next spring. So.
Got it. Thank you very much.
All right, Diane, thanks a lot for your call. And Bob gave us a call earlier, couldn't stay on the line, but he's itching to trim his oak tree. How long does he have to wait? Oh, that was a deep intake of breath, Richard.
He needs to wait until basically after Thanksgiving. So basically late November, December, January, or February.
All right. Next up, we've got Donna in Fort Dodge. Hi, Donna.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
We have a mature green ash tree. And for the last 2 or 3 years, we're noticing sawdust at the base of one side of the tree. The leaves seem to be fine. The tree does not seem to be stressed. I think I'm seeing the large black ants around the tree.
You are.
Okay.
Basically, what you have there is carpenter ants. And carpenter ants are basically just a big black ant. But they're a little bit different than most ants in that they make their home in moist, rotting wood. So apparently there's some rot there within that tree somewhere, and they have taken out some of that rotting wood and placed it outside the nest, typically at the base of the tree. And so you find this very fine sawdust-like material. So, but the carpenter ants are not going to kill the tree. They're not eating the wood, so that's not a problem. The biggest concern is you've got some rot. And if the decay is extensive, then that tree may not be structurally sound, and it may be prone to storm damage. So, but the carpenter ants aren't really a big concern.
All right. Does it may be prone to storm damage also with emerald ash borer on the move? Does it make it more even more vulnerable? I guess all ash trees are so vulnerable.
Yeah. If the tree is close to a house, I would definitely examine the tree, see if I can find maybe the decay or rotting. Mm-hmm. And if it's really a large area, then I might consider removing it or have someone look at it, maybe a consulting arborist.
Okay. All right. And let's get a few email questions in here. And, of course, you're welcome to email us, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This one's from Stephanie in Cedar Rapids. I recently sprayed down an area with a glyphosate herbicide product that was choking with Virginia creeper and some other very prolific vine. I would now like to reseed. Do I need to remove all the dead material before reseeding, or can I get away with breaking up the soil and spreading seed? I currently just have a thatch of dead grass and vines on the surface of the ground.
Okay. Well, you need to get the seed into the soil. So you'll probably have to do some raking to maybe break that soil surface and in the process remove some of that debris, leave the rest, and then sow your seed and then rake it again to work the seed into the soil.
All right. So it's not going to cause a problem if you leave some of that.
Some of it, right. We'll kind of act like a mulch.
Okay. And here's a question from Jim. What specific variety are the muscatine melons?
Oh, that may vary. It depends on the grower. And I can't answer that. I don't know answer to that. It isn't called muscatine.
Right.
Muscatine gets its trademark based on the location.
That
they've
sandy
done a good
soil.
Market. They've
that,
done a
right.
good marketing job of marketing it that way. But I do not know exactly what, and it's not a secret, but I don't know.
All right. Ask at the farmer's market mm-hmm. next time mm-hmm. you see a grower. All right. Here's a question from Linda. We live in Des Moines. How do I tell when the fruit in my pawpaw tree is ready? Our tree is loaded with fruit this year, the first time in 3 years that we've been there.
Oh, boy.
We need Patrick O'Malley to give us a call right now.
He's the pawpaw expert.
Right.
I think I would try simply to taste one, and when you think they're mature, and they should have that kind of banana custard type taste when they're ripe. So I would periodically just pick one off and taste it.
All right. And if she wanted to email the Hortline, you could probably get her in touch with Patrick O'Malley which is hortline@iastate.edu.
Do they soften a little bit?
They should a little bit, yes. Mm-hmm.
All right. And she also says our peach tree is really loaded and some of the fruit is rotting on the tree before it ripens. What causes that?
That could be brown rot, which is a fairly common occurrence on any of your stone fruits as far as cherries, plums, peaches. And if it is, eventually it's colonized by like a white type fungus that covers the entire surface. And then those fruit eventually kind of shrivel up like a mummy. And so if that's the end result, that's brown rot. You want to pick those fruit and discard them. And don't leave the mummies on the tree. Get rid of those, too.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Jim is on the line in Fertile. Hi, Jim.
Hello. How are you?
Good. What's your question?
I live on an acreage with a lot of old growth oak trees on it. And last year, we had one of our trees that developed absolutely no leaves on it. And we thought it was dead. And this year, that tree is full of leaves, but the one next to it now has no leaves on it. And we're just wondering what the heck the problem is.
I can't explain that because a tree that doesn't have any leaves typically is dead. I mean, it has to leaf out every year because it has to manufacture some food. So I'm not sure exactly what happened. Maybe there were a few leaves on it. And for some reason, this year it has far more. But
there was none on it last year.
Well, then I can't explain it because
what is oak blight? I've read about that.
There are a couple of things that we see on oaks. One is oak tatters, where the leaves do form, but much of the leaf is missing. Much of it's gone. It never actually developed fully at all, and so we see that some years. And so the tree does not look very well leafed out. And it's believed to be caused by some type of pesticide. And so you can have that one year, and the next year can be fully leafed out, look great. So that could be one thing. And then we're also seeing on the bur oaks, we're seeing bur oak blight. Bur oak blight occurs on just the bur oaks, and it causes the leaves to turn kind of a brownish color by mid to late summer. And if this reoccurs year after year, eventually it begins to decline and you have fewer leaves, and the tree can actually die eventually. So bur oak blight is more common in the western half of Iowa.
All right, okay. Jim. Yeah, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, let's go to Steve in Indianola. Hi, Steve.
Hi there.
What's your question?
I have black raspberries. This spring when they started to flower out and develop berries, I thought it was just going to be a fantastic yield. As they got closer to being ripe, some of the canes that were holding berries just dried up. The berries got small and hard, and probably half the crop just essentially withered on the cane. The other canes coming out of that same root, the canes that grow up and arc over and make next to these berries, those canes were full and green. So it's not like the roots were dying off. What was going on? Any idea?
Some type of disease, definitely. My first thought would be verticillium wilt. That possibly could be it, where it basically enters a plant through the root system and begins to clog the water-conducting tissue in some of the canes. In response to that, those canes suddenly wilt and die. Possibly some other disease. I think in this case, I'd probably send a sample to our plant diagnostic clinic where they can diagnose it as far as what exactly it is. But I definitely feel it's some type of disease.
All right, Steve, thanks a lot for your call. And we'll get a final question for today from Melanie in Dubuque. We planted a hydrangea bush this spring, and it died within a few months. We are new to this, she says. Two of the stems are green, and two stems have turned brown. The two that are green are now showing new blooms. What should I do about the brown stems? Is there anything I can do to ensure that the full bush comes back next year?
If they're brown, I would assume they're dead. I'd remove them. And as far as protecting them, I might, in November, take some soil and kind of mound that around the base so they have some extra winter protection. Otherwise, they should be okay.
All right. And hydrangea, are they normally winter hardy? Are they?
It depends upon which type it is. The old-fashioned type are perfectly hardy. Some of the newer ones, the big-leaf hydrangeas, tend to be a little bit more finicky.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your question, Melanie. Thank you to all of our callers today. And Richard Giron, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Are you heading to the State Fair?
Yes, tomorrow.
All right. Linda Nave, thank you.
Thank
Are you going to the fair too?
I am today, actually.
All right. Well, have a wonderful day. Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. And Linda Nave, Iowa State University Extension Specialist in Value-Added Agriculture. And I want to say goodbye to a couple of super interns today. Graham Bly worked with us all summer long on the talk show team in Iowa City. Thank you so much, Graham, for all of your good work. And also I want to say thank you to Alex Hansen, who is part of the operations team based in Ames, part of Iowa Public Radio. Thank you both for all of your work, and we wish you all the best in the future. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Have a great weekend.